Welcome to the Body Mind Spirit Podcast, the podcast for the Association for Body Mind Spirit Therapy, otherwise known as the ABMST. My name is Eric Moya, and I'll be your host. This brief interview is one of a series of interviews that are launching this brand new association. The ABMST is a professional association for any practitioner in the world that has a value of integrating the body, the mind, and the spirit in their therapeutic work. If you've gotten to know any body, mind, spirit practitioners, you'll come to recognize that some common values you begin to witness are the values of bridge building and de-siloing. These values come from recognizing that to truly work with an entire person requires a practitioner who avoids thinking strictly in terms of physical bodies, or strictly in terms of psychology, or strictly in terms of the spirit soul, but rather looks to hold all and engage all at the same time. This bridge building and big picture way of thinking is encapsulated for us at the ABMST by the phrase be more, in the sense of be a counselor, but be more than a counselor. Be a massage therapist, but be more than a massage therapist. Be a human, but be more than a human. In short, the ABMST is for like-minded practitioners who embody the spirit and drive of bridge building, de-siloing, and being more. Today, we are visiting with Jeffrey Moss. Jeffrey is an experienced school counselor and doctoral student in the field of community mental health. Jeffrey has a passion for bridge building and social systems and is beloved by both students and parents in the schools where he works. I asked him to participate in these Be More interviews because of his thoughtfulness, community building orientation, and his love of supporting community and also supporting self in that process. Jeffrey, thanks for being here, my friend. Let's just begin real simple. Would love to hear, what does Be More mean for you in both your career and your personal process?
Well, Eric, thank you for having me. You're such an incredible embodiment of that great introduction that you just gave. I think if I can take just a little bit of a license to start with, well, who am I? Which would lead me into what the two things that I sort of think about when I think of that phrase, Be More. So as you mentioned, I am a professional school counselor, and I have been since about 2018 officially. Prior to that, I did some student support roles since 2013. And then prior to that, I've been in a host of other arenas. And so I was a banker at one point, a branch manager for a retail bank, was in retail sales in the federal government, and even worked for the not-for-profit field. And what all of that taught me in my youthful days, if you will, was that my focus was almost entirely on my career. And I eventually got to a point where I realized that I needed to do more than just focus on my career. And so I like this idea of de-siloing because there's so many opportunities missed personally and otherwise that has just sailed away. And so the two areas that I think about when it comes to this idea of be more are how I can be more as a helping professional and how I incorporate the ideas of being more in my clinical practice. There was a concept when I was a banker that was ingrained in us that was called fiduciary responsibility. And that's something that I always carried with me. We were responsible for other people's money and responsible the outcomes of the money and ensuring the controls and all of that was in place. And that was something that we really took very seriously. And I think about, as a clinical professional now, the professional responsibilities that we have. And so as a helping professional, and this concept of Be More for me, I think of things like self-care, professional learning and development, consultation. There's no way we can pour from an empty cup, right? Or a full cup rather, or whatever the case may be, the saying goes. But that we need others to sharpen us, that we need others to lean on, and we need to take care of ourselves. And that was something that in my earlier career, I didn't quite get yet. And I needed that experience and understanding in order to develop and grow on. And I think as in my clinical practice, which is the second part of this now, I can't even get to that until I've done my work. There are so many tough themes that come up in the office. There are so many difficult conversations that have to be had. There's so much consultation that needs to be done. And if I do not take care of myself first and foremost, it's a hard afternoon every day. And so in the clinical practice, and this is the second part of what I'm thinking about here, is that my role is aiding my students on their journey to self-actualization and positive identity formation. And so I am by no means the person steering the ship, right? All the students before me are the ones steering the ship, but I am a guide to them as they go through that. And the tool that I use is something called positive self-regard, right? Something we hear about as clinicians all the time, so that we could look past the hurdles that are before them, the challenges, the weaknesses, and guide them to where they ultimately want to go or where they want to be. And this idea of holism, right, which is the notion that the sum is greater than the parts, and that the parts cannot effectively operate apart from the whole, really guides my work as a clinician, right? And so sometimes a student will present in my office with missing parts to their story. And so we'll spend time searching for those. Other times they have all the parts in front of them, but are operating at a minimal level because they haven't learned to piece those parts together. And so I think about these concepts as I think about this concept of be more that you've presented.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Okay, a lot of different pieces we can jump in on that one. Let's go philosophical. philosophical piece would be, so you mentioned self-actualization in relationship. And everything you're saying, there is this sense that finding our voice, as much as we may think of it as our own, tends to happen in relationship and tends to happen in community.
Yeah.
Could you just expand on that a little bit more? I mean, how do we move away from that individual concept and understand that we're more, we're in relationships?
Yeah.
That's where we discover ourselves. Yeah.
I love that question. And as a community builder, right, I think the key that most people don't understand about true authentic community is that the health of the community is more important than the individual health. However, a community consists of individuals. And so in authentic community, the individual voice truly is important. There is this concept of consensus making, right? And so it doesn't drown out voices. It actually celebrates the individual voice in coming to a collective understanding or agreement of something. And I think, as I sit with individuals in my office and students and adolescents, oftentimes what is being presented to me is actually a collection of other people's voices and other people's beliefs and attitudes.
Kind of reflected in that when through one voice. All right.
Yes. And so sometimes, and this is where the deconstruction has to take place, we have to first get back to their voice and understand what their beliefs and values and attitudes are, so that we can reconstruct in a manner in which is more healthy, developed, more mature. And they can begin to make decisions about, well, is this voice something I want to keep, or is it something more harmful in my life? And so there's a lot of weaving these community concepts into the everyday practice, but also just getting an individual to think about, these voices in context to their own, and their own in context to the communities around them. And it's just exciting work.
Okay, so I love that sort of deconstructing in order to find oneself and start making sense of which voices are given to me and which ones are more authentically my own. It reminds me in Gestalt theory, they'll sometimes talk about like introjects and stuff. This it almost like in this sort of digestion metaphor. Yes. That somebody else's opinion can sit within me and kind of operate kind of unreflected and undigested. And that part of what I hear you saying is that you're helping these young people, these teenagers, more fully digest what's being handed to them.
Yes. And there, and in many ways, I love that analogy. Thank you for that theory. I've been really leaning on choice and reality theory therapeutic techniques lately. And asking two simple questions, right? Well, what is your reality? And we examine that. And then what is your expectation, right? And we kind of take apart, well, I expected this person to say this or to do this. Well, what led you to having that expectation? And really unearthing that sort of voice within them, right? Well, I expected this because this is how I was raised, or this is what was told to me when I was younger, or and really getting to a place of understanding, aha, it really isn't my voice. It really isn't my belief. The question is now, what do we do with that? What do you want to do with that?
I just had a flashback to being like 23 years old, having my very first apartment all by myself, and was basically adulting for the first time and trying to figure, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. Anyway, and I have this memory of having a coffee can underneath my sink where I stored the bacon grease, you know, after I made bacon. And I had never, ever, I didn't know why you did that. I didn't know why you put, I just put bacon grease in the coffee can because that's what I had seen.
Right.
And it took me a long time to figure out like, oh, there's actually a purpose to it. You know, and to me, that's kind of a memory that just crops up as I hear you kind of talk about that a little bit.
I actually tell a similar analogy to my students when we get into a pattern of thinking where I describe to them that there was, you know, this couple and one of them was preparing the ham and they cut the ends off, put it in the crock pot. And the other person would ask the other, you know, person, why do you do that? And well, my mom did it. And okay, they called her mom and her mom said she did it because her mom did it and she was alive. So they called her mom and she said, well, don't be silly. I did that because it didn't fit in my crock pot, right? So we do these things unknowingly because they're tradition, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, how much tradition is unresolved or undigested stuff from our generational legacy? Wow.
Absolutely. Yes.
All right, so here's a going from the theoretical to the practical. All right, so you're talking with somebody and got these questions. What is your reality? What is your expectation? Kind of engaging this whole process. How do you know? How do you know when something is digested finally?
I think that's a great question. And I think for each individual, it's different. There usually is a point in which you realize you have all the pieces in front of you. And I think, you know, just having done this for a while as a clinician, I know when there needs to be more deep diving. I know when there needs to be just kind of step back and summarizing. And I think also you'll see a shift in how a student or, you know, whoever's in front of you is compelled to action. Oftentimes, until someone has decided they need to change, they won't. And so you'll begin to see a shift in that body behavior, the body reactions to certain things when they've seen, they understand and have seen that the change needs to happen. Well, you really begin to feel and see that shift in the body in real time.
Kind of a light bulb moment, but
yes.
Yeah. Witnessing that in a lot of different levels.
Yes.
All right. Well, you know, being careful to protect confidentiality and stuff like that, I would love, do you have a story that you could share with us about this process with you and somebody you worked with, a young person you worked with?
Sure. There's one story, and it's more of a recent story, recent-ish. And, you know, I rarely get young men to submit to actual counseling for any period of time. And so this young man came in to see me and, you know, it's again, it's very clear when they are not sure themselves if they have the pieces, what pieces mean or whatever the case may be. But in his case, did not have all the pieces in front of him and came presenting with some very big, strong emotions, namely anger. And wasn't sure what to do, but wanted to resolve this and very quickly. So he was motivated, to say the least. And so we started, as we usually do, him getting to know me getting to know him. We did a little bit of deep dive in the beginning. And then I usually will set it up near the end of the first session with, this is why we do what we do. And I give series of analogies that, you know, students can kind of chew on and think through. And the analogy I used with him was the invisible backpack. And with that invisible backpack, I tell them to imagine that when they were born, they put on this invisible backpack. And along their lives, what happens is people will say and do things. And those things will deposit little pebbles into their backpack. And I get them visualizing, you know, from 0 to 5 years of age, from 5 to 10, from 10 to however old they are, how many of those pebbles have been deposited in their backpack. And with this particular young man, I asked him at the end, and you could, at the end of it, you can see the weight literally sitting on their shoulders. And I saw it with him, and I asked him, I says, were you aware that this weight was sitting on your shoulders all this time? And he said, no. And he had an aha moment in that moment. And I said, well, the work we do here is we open the backpack together and we begin to take pebble after pebble out and we figure out what to do with it. Does it belong to you? Does it need to go away? Whatever the case may be. And so we set that up. He decided he wanted to go ahead and do 6 to 8 sessions with me. And we started just dealing with each pebble one at a time. The first one was a huge one for him. You know, we worked through some really tough family stuff, gave him some assignments. He did them beautifully, came back. We uncovered some other personal things in his life. And then at one point we hit a wall. He told me he felt like he sees these things, he understands them, but he's still angry. And I said, yeah, I said, I could see that. And we talked through that. We talked through some tools. We set him up on his way and gave him some more homework, came back again. And you could see him getting increasingly frustrated around sessions 4 or 5, like, I'm not changing. And I said, well, okay. I said, that's fair. I says, how long did it take us to get to this point? He told, you know, how old he was and how long it took to get to that point. And I said, well, it's going to take you some time to get you to where you want to be. And so we worked through that. We talked about some ways out. We eventually talked about termination and some referral sources that he could get to some long-term therapy. And before we ended, the look of elation in this young man's face, one of the very last sessions, you know, there were people in his life, very key people that were noticing changes and that were affirming the changes in him. He was practicing the things that we, you know, we worked on, the tools that we gave him. And more importantly, he was excited to do his own therapy. And he, before school let out, he came to me and was like, oh, I got my therapist. I'm excited. We're going to meet. He met before school was out. We came. He told me it was amazing. He sees the light at the end of the tunnel. And it was just one of the best moments, I think, this year in seeing him go from, you know, not knowing to seeing the pieces to hitting the wall to realizing that he's going to have to do this work and take his time to get to that place that he wants to be in. And so, you know, really talking about be more and disiloing and all these other sorts of things in one was, it was a lot of great work with him.
Wow. Fantastic. Yeah. And I love that these stories manage to be both uplifting and kind of heartbreaking all at the same time, you know, and it's like, you know, I don't know this kid, but man, on some level, I'm rooting for him to, yeah, to find that and to, and also like, I mean, I'm sure we could frame it a lot of different ways, but it seems like part of that transformation was one of disempowerment to empowerment.
Absolutely.
You know, and go ahead, please.
I was going to say, and you hit the nail on the head because, you know, the messages we hear, especially from those in our life that we care about, friends, family, whatever, I don't think we realize, like the biggest lie we've ever told is sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt, right? Like, right. They do hurt and they matter. And, you know, we're often having to reprogram some of the stories that we've been told.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and then just reflecting on like the process of anger, like on one hand, anger gives a lot of energy. In one way, it is sort of an empowering type feeling of like, I'm going to take control. Here are my boundaries. This is who I am. But with a cost that, at the end of the day, you realize that underneath it, it's actually disempowering. You know, it's kind of running the show. It's driving the bus. And that in this example, perhaps framing it differently, discovering it differently, having a roadmap for the future, having hope, was able to shift that into what sounds like true engagement and true empowerment.
And relieving some of that anxiety. You know, I just recently saw Inside Out 2.
Oh, I haven't. I've been hearing all about it.
Oh my goodness, Eric, you've got to check it out. But so there's, you know, I won't give too much away, but especially if your listeners haven't seen it yet. But you know, as puberty hit for this person that we're seeing, right? Anxiety takes over the emotions board.
Yeah,
and everything is driven by this anxiety, right? And so it's just, it was such a good illustration for how our lives are.
It's like the first homework for every session you have going forward for your kiddos, right?
Indeed.
Oh, right on. All right, well, two more questions and then we'll go ahead and kind of wrap up a little bit. And so kind of first question is looking backward, and then the second question will be looking forward for you as a person. So here you have this great passion for working within social systems and community building, and this positive regard is kind of a central feature of how you work with people. What led you to this, to these beliefs and these ways of operating?
Oh man, I love your questions. I had a really great mentor in high school, several really good mentors, but one particular who herself was working on her PhD, and I don't know what to this day, but she engaged a small group of us to helping her with bringing a part of her dissertation to life. And wouldn't you know it, it was all about systems thinking, systems archetypes, and eventually we ended up doing this systems dance. And Barry Oshry, if anyone's interested, is the one that kind of pieces this sort of systems dance together and gives a voice to it. But it was something that really piqued my interest and really made me want to do more research. And so that was my foundation, understanding systemically how things work and the individual parts coming together and making the whole work and understanding the role of each of the individual parts. And that could be in anything, right? A family, a school, a organization of some sort, or even the body. And so really using that as my foundation, it springboarded me into Scott Peck's community building processes, four-step community building process. And I tell you, it was just like a virus that took over me. I read more. I wanted to experience more. I talked to people who knew more about it. And what I eventually found myself becoming was an individual who experimented in the community world. And so I did my own little community building exercises with different organizations and worked on, kind of in my own little laboratory, building small communities in different places. And I've seen time and time again how it has transformed the most quiet, the most meek, the most angry, the most whatever you fill in the gap to someone who is more conscious, self-aware, socially aware of others and working towards a common goal. No more than in when I was in New York and I've seen just students from different backgrounds you can possibly imagine, political ideology, racial, cultural, coming together and operating as one efficiently and effectively. And beyond that, leaving the space feeling more self-confident, more self, having higher self-efficacy, a higher sense of self-image. Like these are things that were natural byproducts from having engaged authentically in this process. And so for me, it has every year it's intensified. And so it's something now that as a clinician, I want to marry with that clinical practice, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic. The two pieces I really loved in there was one, the mentorship piece. Well, I mean, I loved everything you said, but I want to highlight the mentorship piece on that kind of setting you and kind of giving you perspectives that you may not have heard otherwise. And then also your own ongoing education and being willing to experiment within it. And I wrote down that Scott Peck community building. If you would, as part of this, we'll be building a contributor page for you. If you got a favorite link on that one,
Sure.
then we
Yeah,
can
yeah,
make sure
yeah.
that people
Let me
who are
know.
following this up can check that out.
Okay.
I know I said one more question, but I got to take a detour because
Go for it.
I'm going to go philosophical again. So it occurs to me, like on this individual versus community, or I mean, I know it's a spectrum, but that I think we have a tendency to want to think of ourselves as isolated individuals. And here now in this conversation, we're talking about the need to transcend that, to move away from the isolated individual and to understanding that individuals are in a relationship and in community. There's a sense, at least superficially, that to subjugate my wants and desires and needs for the sake of community, there is a sense, at least superficially and initially, that I'm acting against my own self-interests, or there could be. And so how do you work with that, with people who are like, why would I, you know, why would I want to do that? I want to look out for myself.
Yeah.
And how it happens to make that shift, that if we can get beyond the self-interest, that actually greater self-interest rewards happen further on down the way. That was needlessly complex, but hopefully I got the question
across. Oh, absolutely. And I'm here for it. So I think first and foremost, when you're entering an authentic space of community building, there needs to be awareness amongst the individuals that that's what's happening, right? It can't just be a surprise. And because of that, one of the ingredients to community building is commitment. There needs to be a commitment to moving together in this process. And so it starts with everybody has at least, we don't know what's going to happen on the journey, but we have at least committed that we're going to be committed to each other and this community and the process. And so I think what invariably happens in this first stage, which is called pseudo community, is we pretend, right? We try to avoid the topics, you know, that are controversial and, you know, whatever, that make us feel passionate. And so it's polite dinner conversation. And what will happen is, you know, there will get a point that somebody will invariably let something slip. They'll say something that's true to their belief, and we enter chaos. And what happens in chaos, this is where the self-interest comes out, right? This is where we begin to expose what we want and what we want to preserve. And it comes out kind of sounding things like healing, correcting, wanting to convert people to certain viewpoints. And so when you start to hear that, you carefully and cautiously guide people back to this concept of, well, what do we need to let go of in order to be in community? Ask the question, what do we need to let go of? And it's up to the individuals to decide, right? We can't be in community if I'm going to hold to this point or believe that this is the only way to community, or this is the only way to the solution. And here's the beautiful thing about community. Again, consensus has to take place. Every voice matters. And so you won't get to that point until you've fought it through, you've argued it through, you've worked it through, and really have come to some point of agreement amongst yourselves. And so it is deeply messy work, intense work, but it is beautiful when you come out on the other side of that, and you can now trust the people you're with. You can relax. You can still be the individual you are without having to fix, heal, or convert other people.
I love so much of that. And I am with you every step of the way. And I'll be honest with you, the word consensus makes me pucker every time. But, you know, apparently sure. there's some work for me to do on that one.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So then leading into our final question, that was kind of our past look. Okay. And now looking into the future, what's the future hold for you? In terms of your personal growth, in terms of your intellectual growth, in terms of your community building growth?
That question couldn't come at a better time in my life. There are so many things happening in transitions, and I'm trying to be both patient, cautious, but, full of zeal as possibly as I can in this process. And so ultimately, you know, professionally, I'm trying to get into a PhD, clinical PhD program that's focused in some ways around community building. I love thinking about this idea of community interventions. But at the same time, I also am just thinking about myself as a professional and the value that I bring to work to different places. And I feel as though the individual contributor just isn't fitting anymore. And I need to do something bigger and more global. And so I am just trying to find that fit. I'm trying to find where I can make a bigger impact and a bigger difference in what I can bring to the table. And so there's a big piece of me that I would have never acknowledged that maybe 5 years ago. It's hard for me to market myself in that way, but I also know that there's just too much investment that has been poured into me to sit back and not give back to others in the way that I know that I can. So I'm striving for higher and better.
Nice. Well, I very much believe that the world has good things to expect from you. And I'm excited to be on the sidelines and witness some of that happen.
Well, I appreciate you, Eric.
You bet. Likewise, and thanks for being here, bud.
You got it.
Thank you for listening. This has been a brief episode of the Body, Mind, Spirit podcast introducing the Association for Body, Mind, Spirit Therapy, or the ABMST. To check out the bio and contact information for our interview today, please come visit us at abmst.org. And if you are a healthcare professional and have an interest in body, mind, spirit therapy, join the ABMST today and become part of the solution that the world needs today and moving forward.